world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Which crash was it that created a brand new aerodynamic design? You ever hear of aerodynamic designers rushing up to a mountainside to rescue the relics of the torn, mangled, twisted shards of metal, of bodies, of seats, and of aircraft instruments and engines as a result of the terrible explosion that scattered wreckage over about a couple of miles of rugged terrain and saying, we've discovered a brand new aerodynamic design? When was the last time you heard of an explosion in a print shop creating an encyclopedia, of an automobile wreck creating a brand new car, or a plane crash bringing about a brand new supersonic jet? Well, I'll tell you, the last time you heard about something just like that was the last time you heard somebody tell you you evolved without a designer. Your kitchen implements that you use, the stove, range refrigerator, the electric oven, and the blender, and all these other things that you have, had to have a designer. Your automobile you drive to work in had a designer. Maybe you don't like the guy, and I'm with you. I don't know why they can't let the poor things alone and do something that makes sense. I got a few things to say about that one of these days if I ever get around to doing something on the automobile. But at any rate, we know that automobiles have, pardon the word, designers. They don't just happen. They don't put themselves together. Why, then, all this enormous faith in accidents? Why do we believe that accidents create beauty and harmony, complexity and interdependability, intricacy, all these other adjectives that mean something that is difficult for us to understand? We live in a time of a belief, an absolute faith, call it even a religious belief, in accidents. Because evolution says that you are the result of a fortuitous series of mindless, random accidents that took place over aeons of limitless time. On the other hand, evolution turns right around to admit that you yourself could not really be the result of an accident because there isn't even enough time allowable in even evolutionary ideas about the age of the universe for such an accident to ever have occurred. I've given you some of the most amazing quotations I think anybody could ever read to you from evolutionists about their own arguments. There was one by a very leading evolutionist in looking even at the eye and at a complicated organ such as the eye really is. It's far more complicated than your television set, but you're not going to tell me that television set is the result of an explosion. I'll tell you, when you stop to think of what you paid for it and maybe what you still owe on the thing, you know, it's got to be fairly intricate. There must be something in there that's happening when you turn those knobs, and sometimes you don't do it just right and you get the thing all out of whack, and unbeknownst to you, maybe because you don't have the operator's handbook or something, you call a TV repairman, you say, I don't know what's wrong with my set. It's doing this, or it's going beep, or it's going crazy all the time. All it shows me is a pattern. Whatever it is, the guys have heads like this, you know, or they're making swimming motions while they're supposed to be walking. And so the guy says, sure, we'll take it to the shop. And he takes it to the shop, turns about three buttons, stores it for 3 days, comes back, and charges you about $75. At least this is one of those things on Suspicions Confirmed. You've seen the comic, I think, Suspicions Confirmed. Well, I'll tell you this, your eye, with its cornea and its retina and the rods and cones and the fantastic, intricate mechanism it is far more complicated than that television set. And I think we would have to admit it took at least as much intelligence to put both of them together, wouldn't you say? Well, then how can we think that our eye and our ability to see is the result of mindless, blind chance? Well, here is a quotation from an evolutionist admission in the book called Nature and Man's Fate. His name is Garrett Hardin, about the eye, its intricacy. He said, how then are we to account for the evolution of such a complicated organ as the eye? Detractors point out, even if the slightest thing is wrong, if the retina is missing or the lens opaque or the dimensions in error somewhere, the eye is consequently useless. Any part of it, if it doesn't actually work everything perfectly, and there's so many different parts, then it's useless. Since it must be either perfect or perfectly useless, how could it have evolved by small, successive Darwinian steps? Now, that's a question that a scientist asks, and I think it would do us well as laymen to ask the same kind of questions. It isn't unscientific to ask, how could an eye have evolved? Because the first, you know, a blob, an amoeba that kind of divided, didn't have an eye. But finally, you know, we look around us and we see whales and birds have eyes. You know, a fly could be an eye as well as a fly. It's only a fly because that's what it does, but it sees too. You know, a fly could be a hop or a walk. We have these technical, intricate names for things. We call this little critter a fly. That's because it flies. It does that. And we call it a house fly because when it's inside, I guess that's what it is. When it's outside, what is it? An outside fly? It could be anything, but if you ever looked at what you think is the head of a fly doesn't have a head. He's just got two great big buggy eyes. I don't know where his head is. Maybe it's inside his eyes. But he doesn't just have two eyes. He's got lenses all over the place. He looks like Mount Palomar. He looks like an observatory with wings. And this guy is seeing everywhere. Try to catch a fly. It takes quite a trick. You got to kid him. You got to go by a little bit in the air and let him fly into your hand. It's kind of fun catching flies for kids and pulling their wings off, tormenting the little things for having caused them all that bother. But you know, a fly's eyes, and it has many of them. Hey, did you know clams got eyes? You've probably seen the comic strip, but you know there was a beautiful National Geographic. It showed that scallops and different kinds of clams have rows of eyes. And I'm not kidding you, little blue eyes, just real pretty little eyes that stick out all over, and they're looking in every direction you can imagine all at the same time. You know, you begin to think sometimes, I know people that have handicapped children might think this, why is it that a mosquito or a fly can have such intricate mechanisms? I mean, they smell real well, you know, but babies, human babies, can be born with these terrible defects because of what we do to ourselves. Well, it's something to ponder sometimes, isn't it? But if the retina is missing or something is wrong with a human eye, it just doesn't work. It's an intricate mechanism. Did it just happen by accident? The objection, he says, is a formidable one, but it no longer looks unanswerable. Were all organisms blind, the animal which managed to evolve even a very poor eye would thereby have some advantage over others by selecting examples from various places in the animal kingdom. We can assemble a nicely grade series of eyes passing by not too big steps from the primitive eyes of oysters. Here he admits that oysters have eyes. Maybe it's oysters, not clams, but it's some shellfish, to the excellent eyes of birds and men. Now, such a series made up from contemporary species is not supposed to be the actual historical series, but it shows us how evolution could have occurred. So once again, we take what is called a simple eye, in evolutionary parlance, and then we take a more complex eye, and then we take a very, very intricate eye, like the human eye, maybe. Well, a human eye is nowhere near as good as an eagle's eye. It doesn't see as well. You try to pick out a mouse from that kind of altitude. You couldn't do it. It's like George says to Martha, oh, look at there, the people down there look like ants. You're in an airplane, you know, and we must be very high. They are ants, you fool. We haven't taken off yet. The human eye just cannot see even the way a bird's eye can. Well, you know, it's time we took a bird's eye view of evolution, maybe looked into it a little more closely than we do with the human eye, and asked a few embarrassing questions. Is evolution really true, or are there infallible proofs that a divine creator God does exist? In just a moment, I'll come back to give you proof number 5.
One question that has bothered man for centuries probably has bothered you too. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem, and it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? Whether you feel that organized religion is ritual or reality, the question still remains. The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a creator God. There is no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. Request your free copy of Does God Exist? Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
To see or not to see? That is the question. If you've got an eye to see with, then you see. Now, I know that people can begin to lose vision, but you know what I mean. An eye either works or it is absolutely useless. Now, to say, because you assemble what is called a simple eye. Well, what's a simple eye? A simple eye, all it does is see. Now, what's simple about seeing, please? There is no such thing as a simple eye. An eye either does what it's designed to do. It's kind of like going down to buy a used refrigerator. You see, it's got a dent in the lid. So you say, what does it do? And she says, it keeps your food cold. You might as well buy that one as a new one. It does the same thing. The only question is how long it's going to last and what does it look like. But it certainly functions or it doesn't function. When you plug it in, you want to get the results. That's the whole thing. Well, evolution is a belief in accidents. And you were not an accident. Well, now, maybe you weren't planned by your parents, because there are lots of accidents around the world today, but I mean human beings, a human hand, a human eye, the human skeletal and muscular and nervous and circulatory and digestive system. This is not the result of a fortuitous series of accidents. The first major proof I gave in a series is that law, intricate law, immutable law, demands a lawgiver. The second proof was that life, the existence of life, demands a life-giver. Life does not come into existence apart from pre-existing life. The third major proof is the very fact that a creation, matter, the material universe, and all of its building blocks and all of its atoms and its molecules and the billions and billions of tons of rock and earth and soil, the liquid, the solid, the gas, and we went back and forth through so many different examples of it in so many programs. All of it does exist. Creation demands, to any rational, logical mind, a creator. The next proof was the immutable succession of life reproducing according to its own pre-existing kind. And I showed how in the book of Genesis, the first chapter, God said, let the earth, the living creature, bring forth after his kind, and it was so. Now, is that archaic? Is that Genesis 1? Is that ancient Hebrew literature that belongs to some yesteryear time of pagan philosophy? Is it merely poetry or ancient music that Hebrew parents sang to their kiddies to put them to sleep? Or isn't that what you observe with your eye? Isn't that what you see and what you understand by your own human mind? That kind reproduces according to kind. That humans produce humans and horses horses, and thanks be to our God, there is never any expectancy on the part of either that there will be any interlapping or overlapping or sudden leap so that a human produces a horse or vice versa, in spite of what pagans used to believe. Evolution admits it has no proof. It admits there are endless gaps, that there are giant missing segments of the chain. They don't have a chain with a few missing links. They got a few links with a missing chain. It's a completely different story when you look at it correctly and accurately. Now, the fifth major proof that there is a God is the intricate design all around you. Maybe it sounds schoolboyish and first grade-ish to talk about the rose petal, or the chicken and the egg, or the human hand, or the wing or the eye of a fly, or the wing of a bird, or the migratory instincts of fowl, or the feeding habits of whales, or plankton or krill, or whether you're talking of microorganisms in the soil or the web of life in earth or even in the sea. It's all a matter of intricate design, and some of the intricacies in nature are so absolutely complicated you just can hardly believe it. You know, bats came up with radar before human beings. Some fish had sonar long before submarines. There are creatures that have abilities that are instinctive, that are far more intricately designed than some of the most marvelous mechanisms of our modern technological era you could even imagine. I want to give you a couple of three of these. Radar, counter-radar, heat-seeking, homing devices, chemical warfare, intricate miniaturization. These all, actually, are old stuff in the animal world. In these days of technological triumphs and of lunar walks, of humankind with our miniaturization and our little cocktail ollies receivers for spying, we really think we've done it all. We think humankind is virtually replacing God, that we can do so much that we stand in awe of science. Well, you know, the creatures all around us beat us to every bit of it. They had it way before we did. Before and during World War II, Our government spent billions of dollars developing and perfecting radar to learn later that the bat had the secret all along. Well, I think I just read some United States of American propaganda, didn't I? Yes, it says our government spent billions developing and perfecting. Well, we might have spent billions perfecting it, but radar began to be used by the British in the defense of Britain before the Americans ever began to use it. I just like to say that. Ounce for ounce and watt for watt, bat radar and sonar is billions of times more efficient and more sensitive than a radar and sonar contrived by man. The bat navigates by means of an acoustical system that outdoes man's most sophisticated sonar apparatus and is now the subject of intense study by Air Force and Navy researchers. You may have seen some of the film where they put bats in a kind of a maze and put all sorts of very heavily, well, I don't know what it was. It was acoustical material, kind of like fiber and so on. And the poor bat flew blindly into all sorts of obstacles. But the minute it had any kind of a maze, it could be an intricate maze with one little small hole through several different walls misplaced or displaced in different areas, as long as there was any surface there for those little sounds which you can't hear with your ear to bounce back, the bat could navigate them without any miss. It's amazing to me. If I'm out in the lake fishing in an evening, which I have been a few times in my life, all right, and it's time for the bats to come out, you've heard the old wives' tales about bats getting in your hair, don't you believe it? Don't you, especially if a woman's got her hair in curlers, you wonder what wavelength she's tuned into. Well, man, that must be a blip on a radar scope for a bat's brain bigger than a giant weather cell for a 707. No bat's going to fly into a woman's hair. He just isn't going to do it. When you see bats swooping and darting and fluttering around, you know what they're doing? They're catching insects in their mouth. And they're doing so by a fantastic radar, the emission of a shrill squeak that bounces off that little object so fast and comes back to the bat that in rapid flight it can grab the thing in midair, which reminds me of the fisherman who was out one evening with one of the big 7-foot bass rods, a little cork popper, and he was casting away along the shore for bass, and he cast back and something hung up, and he looked around and started to reel, and he had a bat flying around in the middle of the air that grabbed the thing in flight. Some things possibly happen like that. I don't know whether I believe that story or not, but I read it somewhere. When it flies in the darkness, a bat then emits ultrasonic waves that bounce off objects and obstacles, then echo back to the bat, whose receiving system tells the bat what's ahead in the dark, evaluating the shape, believe it or not, the texture of it, and the action. This is all fantastic because I've looked at a lot of radar scopes. When I was in the Navy, I had to stare at a radar scope by the hours to look at aircraft coming and going. And one of the gun directors aboard an aircraft carrier. And I'll tell you, all you see for an airplane is just a little speck of light. You can't tell really how big it is, though some bigger aircraft give off a bigger blip than little ones, but you can't tell its shape, its texture. All you can tell is that it's out there, and it may not even be an airplane. But a bat outdoes us because it can even tell in advance whether it's something it wants to eat or not, whether it's got a soft body or a hard one. It accomplishes this feat, moreover, with miniaturized equipment that technologists, even whose marbles are built into space capsules, have not matched. A bat's complex analyzing nerve mechanisms, for example, are so small that every last bit of it could fit onto the head of a hat pin. And bats easily find insects in the darkest of night. Did that all happen by accident? How did bats get their food previous to this time? How did the first bats find those insects, minus the good eyesight, when they first started clinging upside down in caves? The first bat that flew out at night to find an insect had to find one, or else he didn't live very long. And if he did live, and of course there are millions of them around, then he had to be able to find those insects. And if he did, he had to be using that bat radar that he's got right now today. So bats, the very first time they flew, in order to survive, had to survive in the same way they've always been surviving, by the intricate mechanism of bat radar. That proves intricate design. And a design demands a designer. How about you? Did you have a designer, or did you just happen?
There's a new Europe coming. From the days when Europe was reduced to rubble at the end of World War II, the plain truth has been predicting its rebirth as a world power. As this European bloc develops independently of the United States and Russia, the plain truth keeps you informed with advance articles. And now, as the European common market emerges economically and politically to shake the world, The Plain Truth brings you the dramatic story behind Europe's return to power. With articles like Cracks in the Atlantic Alliance and Who Speaks for Europe, The Plain Truth helps you keep ahead of events in this fast-moving world at a price we can all afford. It's free. The Plain Truth, after 40 years, still ahead of its time. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
So many people believe in accidents today, you almost begin to believe it is a religion. I once heard of an experiment, I think they recorded this, where they took a grand piano and pushed it off a roof, and then recorded the sound it made when it smashed into the concrete below, and then people sit around and criticize this and decide whether it is good or bad music. Now, you know, some jam sessions that have created some of our music are happenings. That's when people gather together and haul out the instruments and kind of begin, and maybe they've had a little help in advance via the main line, who knows, and then something just kind of comes out of it all. It's a kind of a happening, and then they call it music. I've seen pictures of people with frenzied rage scooping up blobs of paint in both hands and attacking a canvas. I've even heard of cases where people had nudes diving in buckets of paint and slithering all over canvases and then putting them up for people to come by and stare at and say, you know, and they get some kind of a kick out of this. I remember one down in the museum. It was, I think it was just plain white, and it had one big red stripe down the middle of it. I looked at it and I thought, man, it's taken that painter a long time to come back for the second swatch. But anyhow, it was in a frame, so I finally tumbled to the fact that this was on display. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was a bare section of wall. You know what had a title? Underneath it, it said, Adam. I was standing there laughing at it. That's the way I appreciate that kind of art, and a guard came up. I was making too much noise. You're supposed to be as quiet in there as you are in a church. So I can't understand why people would take a bottle cap, a rusty nail, a piece of welding, an old sole of a shoe, a beer can label, and then maybe a shingle or something, nail it all up to a piece of wood, stick it on a wall, and call it art. But we believe in accidents these days. We believe in accidental art, accidental music. Little kids, when they get together and they have an accident, mama's kind of irate with them. Now we got teenagers getting together and having accidents, and it takes the county cleanup crew to go out there and clean up after them. You know, when people get together and when you have an accidental happening, it always ends up in degeneracy. It doesn't create something wonderful. It ends up going downhill. An accident is a mistake. Wars happen by accident. But love does not. We get it all backwards. We say, when I fall in love, you know, people don't fall in love. They either grow to love one another. Gardens don't happen. They're planted. And love doesn't happen. Love has to be very carefully nurtured and made to grow. It's not an accident. It's the result of careful design and very tender care after it has been created. Wars can come about by accident. Injury occurs by accident. Death comes about by accident. But life, even though some people perhaps don't intend to have a child when they do, there's nothing accidental about it. It is the result of complex, marvelous, fantastic design. Inexplicable, there are not adjectives enough to explain the miracle of birth. I have seen two out of the three of my own children born. And that is an absolutely awesome thing to experience. The miracle of birth of a tiny baby that began as a little microorganism and in 8 weeks' time began to look a little bit human, and that gradually grew until at parturition or birth, that baby has built into it all of the qualities of both parents, texture of skin, eventual height, shape, and weight, possibly even the timbre and the nature and the color of the voice, the kind of eyes and the color and texture of hair. I mean, look at the Japanese people and black people and Chicanos and whites and so on. What is this business of race if it is not the intricate, infinite variety of which the human body and the human reproductive capacity is endowed with? And how did it all get started? It's a matter of intricate design, not just a happening. We're not some random mistake of the universe fortuitous chance with a capital C, were the result of design. We were put here for a purpose. Science can give us no reason for living. It can make life a little pleasanter in some ways and become a giant curse upon us in the same way sometimes. Like it makes it a little pleasanter the first go-around, maybe, to be able to transport your body from point A to point B a little more rapidly in an automobile. But when you get enough of those automobiles on the road, and you get maybe one car per person, like in the Los Angeles area, then it becomes a giant curse. But science can, outside of designing and inventing, and that is another factor of the human mind too, and creating all the artifacts and the gadgets and all the intricate mechanisms that surround us to labor save and to save steps and to make our homes cooler and to keep our food refrigerated, science nevertheless can give us no purpose in being, no purpose in living. Scientists cannot by themselves, of themselves, through a test tube, through the understanding of the human physical makeup, understand why we are. Science is not even sure what we are. In this brochure I've talked about, A Theory for the Birds, we have used science. What is known, what is absolutely proved by science, and we have used the technology available to us too, of our own research, of our own very beautiful photography and microscopic photography to prove what is fantastically designed, to prove that there are seven proofs that God created the entirety of this universe, and to prove, most importantly, some of these great missing gaps of evolution, and particularly in the field of genetics and of biology, and to show that evolution is only a belief, an empty faith in absolutely nothing. Now, did birds actually evolve from a reptilian-like creature? Did feathers come from a loosely hanging scale? It's absolutely ridiculous to believe that, and when you write for this brochure, a colorful brochure, it'll be very enjoyable for your children, you will see just how ridiculous it is to believe the breathtaking array of all the creatures around you could have evolved without the limitless intelligence of a creator God. You will see all of these marvelous, intricate patterns in a bird. The kinds of bird, when I say kinds, I really mean varieties, of course, within a kind. Even the bone structure that is porous. You will see the feathers with their little barbicules and the interlinking, interdependent little interwoven meshwork that makes up the fantastic complexity of a bird's feather. You will see all about nest building. And all of this about migratory birds, the tale of a terrified tern, and how did the very first bird migration patterns get started? How could they, unless they were immediately successful the very first time? There had to be a very first migration. This we know. Now this brochure will come to you by return mail, free of charge. It's a humorous brochure. I think it's about time we did take a little bit of a crack at evolution. They've taken plenty of cracks at religion in the past. I'm not talking about people. I'm not talking about an organization. I'm talking about a theory. And I will attack that theory as long as God gives me breath, because that is just a theory. And this booklet does that, A Theory for the Birds. All you need to do to receive this brochure is to give us the call letters of your station. We'd like that. You would, please? The call letters of your radio station. While you're at it, why don't you request the current number of The Plain Truth and find that there is a solution beyond human understanding. And we talk in The Plain Truth plainly even about Bible prophecy and about an ultimate solution beyond the acknowledgement of today's news media, because they simply do not acknowledge God or Bible prophecy. And that's what you will read in The Plain Truth. It is plain truth, straight from the shoulder, plain talk. I hope you'll write for it. We'll send it to you by return mail as soon as you dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.